Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello there, Dr. Ross Green here. Welcome to another edition of Helping Behaviorally Challenging Students. I am very glad that you are able to join us today. We're going to have a special guest today, and I'm looking to see if I gave our special guest the right call-in number, and I didn't. So I'm going to email him right now and let him know that I gave him the wrong call-in number. Hold on. Let me see here. And he's not going to be able to get it through anyways because we have all of our educators panel members on the line with us today. So I'm going to bring you all on. And I know we have Tom and Nina and Carol and Sue. How are you all today?
Woo-hoo, we're all here.
Yeah.
Good. Unprecedented. Here's the problem with you all being here, and no, I'm not going to ask for volunteers, but our special guest today, this setup only allows for four callers besides me. And so he can't get through even if I had given him the right number. But I gave him the wrong number. Now I'm giving him the right number. Hang on one second. This is my life these days. Hang on. So I will send him this now. But does any of you have something that you so badly need to do in your building that you would like to be excused from today's program? This is me like being like an airline. You know how airlines sell more seats for a flight than they
standby?
Think people are going to show up? What's that?
Did you want
well,
to put
we want
one
to give you
standby.
A voucher for a different trip by getting bounced off this flight is what we really want to do.
Exactly.
So we're asking for volunteers to take a voucher to take a different flight. Do any of you want to volunteer for that?
I feel like I've been talking a lot. I'd be fine to go and come another time. Let Tom and Carol and Sue go ahead.
And I'm fine too, Ross. It's either way, you know.
Nina volunteered first. We're going to let her go. Now, Nina, does your phone number begin with 384 or 865?
384.
You have been thrown off the plane.
Okay.
Pull the cord, Nina. Pull the cord.
All right. I will listen and
you can come back here
from afar.
Maybe one of us will go off again.
Okay. Thank you.
Nina, thank you for volunteering.
Bye,
your voucher will be at the offices of Lives in the Balance the next time you're here.
Perfect. Bye.
That's awesome.
Well,
so now
thank
who's
you
our
for,
special guest, Ross?
Our special guest, if he's paying attention to his email, because I just sent the – otherwise we will have bounced a passenger and are still going to have an empty seat. Our special guest is Tim Graves, who is the current co-director but full-time superintendent of schools and programs at the Near North District School Board, located roughly in North Bay, Ontario, but in other towns proximal to that. I spoke in North Bay last week and had dinner with Tim. First of all, North Bay, Ontario is yet another school system that is implementing the CPS model. And some schools doing better than others. And Tim and I had a very interesting dinner conversation. And if Tim doesn't get the email, then we'll have this conversation ourselves. But the reason I wanted him to come on is because he's familiar with schools in his school district that are implementing the model and wanted to. and those that wanted to but are not implementing the model as well. And we had a discussion about the schools that seem to be able to do it and the schools that seem to be unable to do it. And he had some very different, very interesting ideas about that. But he apparently isn't paying real close attention to his email right now and called the number I gave him and is probably sitting there waiting for us to come on the air. So he's probably wondering what went wrong. But that's okay. We can talk about it and hope that he gets his email. The thing is, the reason I wanted Tim to come on, and worst case scenario, we have him at the beginning of the next year due to my screw up. The reason I wanted Tim to come on instead of just our educators panel is you all have experienced success of implementation in your buildings, and some of you have been in different buildings. He's familiar with schools that are in his district that have wanted to and have done it, and also those that have wanted to and haven't. But let's open the discussion among the rest of us, and let's see where it goes, and I'll see if I can get a hold of Tim or have Sheila, our associate director, get a hold of Tim and see if we can get him on the line. But let's start. What are your thoughts about the schools that are able to do this when they want to and those that are not able to do this when they want to?
Well, I know in my building and in Surrey, I believe that one of the reasons is because we give them time. We give the teachers release time. So I know that my teachers have said a great deal about having that opportunity to do it during the school day and having their classes covered rather than staying after school or doing it in the morning before school begins. So I know that that's a really big draw for us at this school. I don't know what it's like at other schools in Surrey. So I know that's a really big deal for us here. We're an inner city school, so we're super busy throughout the day, jumping from like crisis to crisis. So it's nice to get that time to actually work with a child one-on-one during the day.
And I can speak to also in the same district, not having that same level of support available. Like I know Susan has an incredible counselor who's basically, you know, meeting with teachers, helping them, coaching them with the model, but also being the one and with some other staff providing the time for the teachers to do that, to meet. And without that, it's really hard because it then falls generally to just one or two people, myself as the principal or, say, a child care worker, you know, who are, I don't want to say we're unreliable, but, you know, when things pop up, sometimes you may have planned to meet with a teacher or to support a teacher, and then something else pops up and it gets pushed aside. So having that dedicated time, just like with any, you know, initiative where you're hoping that people will collaborate on something is really, really important.
It makes a huge difference, and I know we just did an ALSUP with a teacher last week. My child care worker did it with her, and she was, of course, theorizing and hypothesizing, and it took a few reminders not to do that and how difficult that is starting off with somebody new. And the coaching makes a huge difference, having somebody helping you along with the ALSUP. And we usually have two people in there, our child care worker and Ron, our counselor. So it just makes it so doable for the teachers, which is great.
So here's the good news. I think Mr. Graves is now on the line with us. Tim, are you there?
Oh, great.
Hello, how are you?
Tim, I
good.
Apologize.
Hi, Tim.
How I got that number, I have no earthly idea. But I would like to introduce you to our panel here. We've nixed one of them because somebody had to give up their seat so this plane could leave the gate. And one of our panel members graciously agreed to take a voucher for a later flight so that we could fit you in, because this arrangement only permits 5 callers, and I'm one of them. So you're on with Tom Ambrose, who is a principal in Maine, Carol Davison, who is a principal in British Columbia, and Sue McQuaig, who is a building principal in British Columbia. And I have already introduced you to them. and told them that you and I had a very interesting conversation over dinner, that you're with the Near North District School Board, and that you had some knowledge of schools that within your district that have been trying to implement the CPS model. And by the way, on this program, if you say collaborative problem solving, as Tom so frequently does,
you get thrown off the plane.
Right, you get thrown off the plane. The emergency
collaborative and proactive solutions.
Correct. Right. Collaborative and proactive solutions. You can always say CPS. But if you would share your thoughts with us, because this is a very talented group you're on the line with here. These are thinkers and learners. If you can recap your thoughts that I heard over dinner the other night about buildings and the characteristics of buildings that seem to be able to implement this and those that struggle with it more, wait till you hear what these people are going to weigh in. Tell us what you and I were talking about.
I think what we were talking about was the notion of, is the culture within your school one of thinking or one of just doing? We've been looking at our student achievement and well-being agenda for quite some time and struggling with, I think, what most systems and principals struggle with is, it's a great idea, but we're struggling with the implementation and what are the characteristics that need to be in place for the implementation. So we looked carefully at those and how, where things were successful and where things weren't, and we came up with the notion that we need to have really, before we worry about real implementation, we need to make sure that we have what we're calling in our system as a professional culture, and we're talking about a culture where people are thinkers, where they're learners and they're doers. And we looked at a lot of our professional learning communities, and I know that that's also in the book, in the discussion around that, and I think we had to be honest with ourselves that our professional learning communities, and I think the same would be true across our province anyway, are often just sneakier ways to do Plan A, a kinder, gentler Plan A. And what we have found is Plan A really just doesn't work with high-achieving, hard-working, highly skilled professionals. So we thought we had a culture of just doing. What's the next thing on the list? Let's do it. What that leads to is it leads to us failing to really think through all of the details, and it's more about getting it done than it is asking ourselves the deep questions that are causing us reflection, how and when and why in each particular school. So we know we have one school. We have 14 schools on this journey right now. We're a school board of just over 30 elementary schools, and we have 14 elementary schools on various steps of this journey. But our biggest success has been where, A, you have a principal that has already been working hard on developing that culture, where, you know, a culture that looks a little bit like Plan B for a wide variety of initiatives in the school. We know that the principal really did more than read the book. They did some advanced training. We also have a couple of system level people who are doing a certification training at the same time, and they really relied on each other. They sort of went at this process with a co, started with a small group of the willing, and really started working with our frequent flyers first, the most difficult, the kids with the most challenging behavior, and it seemed to gain traction immediately. The other thing that we have noticed is that if you don't keep the conversation on the table all the time, it falls off pretty quickly. So that's the short version.
All right. So I was thinking that our principals here would have some interesting thoughts about this learners versus doers concept. I think it's very interesting, to tell you the truth. And I was imagining that, and nothing against Carol or Susan, who always have thoughts on lots of things, but I can imagine Tom chewing on this right now and thinking about what he learns when he goes off to Columbia University, to their things they put on for educators. And I was thinking that the honorary American on this program today, Tom, might have some interesting thoughts about this. Tom, I can hear you chewing on this over the phone line. Let's start with you.
Well, you know me too well, Ross. I think that's, you know, this the I think it, the first thing is that thinking about is it Dr. Greaves or Mr. Greaves? I'm sorry.
Tim's fine.
Oh, Tim. Okay. So Tim had a really good point that there is an inherent shift in culture from doing or just kind of meeting in PLCs, which have kind of become a catchword phrase for any kind of meeting that goes on, a professional learning community. But a true professional learning community is actually designed around what I talk to staff about, two things. One is adaptive change versus technical change. So technical change is kind of like the to-do list that Tim was talking about. You know, these are some technical things that we need to do to, if we want to implement the Teachers College Reading and Writers Workshop, we need to teach mini lessons and use these units of studies. And we need to have, you know, students follow the structure, which is a mini lesson, and then they read independently and work with partners. That's like the to-do list stuff that needs to happen. Or on a lower level, the to-do list stuff is, okay, when's our field trip? What time is our assembly? Those are to-do list things, too, that have absolutely nothing to do with the professional learning community. And when you start to examine adaptive change, that's when you start to look at student work, student behavior, and what you're going to do about them and work as a team in an area that, frankly, you don't know the answer to. So the definition of adaptive change would be the gray area. And so when I'm working with staff, I'm constantly asking them, what are your students doing? What do you want them to know and be able to do at the end of this unit? Where are they now, and how are we going to get them there using the things that we have available? That could be anything from strategy groups to partner work to contacting parents to help them work with their reading or writing or math. Could be using, call myself, using Plan B or collaborative and proactive solutions. It could be just having them spend some time with the teacher eating lunch and talking about how things are going in a non-punitive way. I think that the real work of any PLC can only happen when there's a culture ultimately of trust that each person can reveal their weaknesses so that their colleagues can support them in developing the strengths. And a lot of people don't like to use the medical model for this conversation, but the reality is that if a doctor's treating a patient and the patient's not getting better, what's the first thing a good doctor does? They call some colleagues and have them take a look at it. And then they talk about the treatment plan and they make adjustments and get other perspectives. And so that's exactly what great teachers do. They have a kid that isn't moving in the direction that they want them to, and they're not afraid to reach out to their colleagues because there's a good team culture. So spending that time to develop that team culture is critical to the development of the success of any organization, really, let alone a school.
I couldn't
Carol?
Agree with you more.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tim. Sorry. Go ahead.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think we have spent a lot of time talking about informed prescription versus real collaborative inquiry and the open-to-learning stance that we need to encourage our leaders and our educators take when we go at these sorts of meetings or when we go at our PLCs, because the truth of the matter is if we knew the answer already, we would have implemented the solution.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. If you didn't know the answer, we wouldn't be meeting. Or if we knew the answer, why would we need to meet?
Mm-hmm. I agree. Mm.
Great point, Tim.
So how does that fit into the learners versus doers paradigm? Maybe I'm the slow one here.
Well, I think we have often, I think we as a system have often had the expectation that the teachers were doers, right? I mean, and that should be doers. And all we need to do, because we at the center are so learned and knowledgeable, is tell them what to do, and they will do it. And we've looked at sometimes either our system or our people, maybe not even intentionally, with a deficit stance as opposed to an asset stance, right? Instead of saying, you know, all of our professionals are working really hard and are well-intentioned, but for some reason we can't seem to have the deeper conversations that we have. And why is that? And I think if we were to really look carefully, it's because we've asked them or we've created structures in which they get told what to do, and their job is to implement, not really question why.
Or, Tim, can I ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
When you say not really question why, do you mean maybe I just wanted to understand why you would do, like, so I'm thinking through the lens of implementing instructional practices or collaborative and proactive solutions. If you're implementing something, I think having a conversation about why you would be implementing it would be critical to get the buy-in component. But then there's another level of once we've kind of moved through the why, going to, okay, this is what we're going to move forward with, and then it gets more into the gray of how to do it effectively. Is that just a subtle difference? Am I just kind of, or I was trying to just go a little deeper into that.
Yeah, no, I think you're thinking in line with mine here. I think really it's about, you know, you think of it, are we coming to the table with our educators with the solution in mind already, or are we coming with the problem, and are we giving them a voice in solving the problem? So you might think of a board or a system improvement plan that names one particular thing. Well, do all schools have to do that one particular thing? What about the school that's already good at that? And sometimes we've written these grandiose plans where everybody has to do something regardless of their data. And I think, you know, coming to the table with the solution already in hand is something that we're trying not to do in the collaborative and proactive solutions model, and we ought not to do that for any implementation.
Well, you know, I kind of have a term for that type of leadership, or I call it it's like when you differentiate for your students, you're using differentiated leadership and differentiated professional development. So when we have professional development, I keep advocating for, let's have a professional development day where there are six different like stations or hour and a half, and teachers can choose to go to three of the six based on their specific needs and their data.
Absolutely.
I think it's interesting that the one-size-fits-all workshop is just an explosion of this idea that you're discussing. So why would I ask somebody who's really good at the empathy step in a Plan B conversation? They don't need to go to more training on that. Maybe they need to go to the training on the part about filling out the LSUP effectively, or they need to go to a part of the training that meets their needs based on what they're experiencing in the classroom. You know, nothing bothers me more than to see a teacher sit through a management training for the whole building when they have incredible management.
Exactly. And then to take it a step further, perhaps, let's take that professional development, those resources, and move them into the school and see how we can make it job embedded. I think from our approach, we get far more for our professional development dollars if we work in the schools with the teachers on their time frame, on their particular challenges of practice, rather than pulling them out on a particular day.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that goes back to, we had one last point, Ross, and then I think Tim and I could probably get together and have dinner or something myself. But Tim, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the key to that piece with learning collaborative and proactive solutions started to happen for me more when a teacher would bring a recording of a conversation to a staff meeting and let the staff listen to it and then take feedback from the staff.
Mm.
That really shows, A, that the culture is super healthy, that the person has courage, they trust their colleagues. But the colleagues were really great about the feedback and were more interested in applauding the fact that the teacher was willing to play the conversation almost at first than going into the feedback. So there's that subtle piece of first getting people to put themselves out there to get the feedback, but then there's the next piece of getting to the real feedback that could help the person grow, where the real risk-taking happens. And when professional development is embedded in a building, that culture grows very quickly. So when we have a math strategist come and do a lesson in front of 10 teachers with a real class, and then they have a question and answer session, it goes from theory to practice. Well, it's the same thing with this process of learning how to do this model. If you have a teacher who's willing to work with a child and let other people hear it and see it and be with it, then it becomes real to everybody in the room instead of just this theory of, okay, you listen and then you share your concern and then you do this, then you do that, right? It's that part that you were saying about the doing versus learning.
Yeah, and I think it's so important that the formal leaders in the building, whether they're team leads or department heads or the principals, participate as co-learners, right? Instead of our leaders being our lead knowers, we have to help them become lead learners. And you know, in Robinson, did some work around the five domains of effective instructional leadership, and participating and promoting professional development with teachers is by far and away the most important thing you can do.
I agree with you 100%.
Well, let's see if Susan and Carol agree with you guys 100%. I have a feeling they will, because we tend to think alike on this program. But Susan, Carol, you want to... Tim would not be saying anything that anybody was outraged about, but go ahead.
I certainly agree with all those points. It makes a great deal of sense. And, yes, I know Carol is involved, and I am certainly involved with the professional development around CPS, and I promote it all the time on staff. I work with the students. I do the LSATs. I'm totally involved. But ours is slightly different than what it sounds like in both of your schools. This isn't mandated in my school. Like, it's not something that we have the right to do here in British Columbia, that this would be a professional development like math or something else where we have to, where everyone has to participate. So, for example, on my staff, we started with a very small group of people who were interested, and that was... The interest was gained from me doing professional development in the summer, where I brought up the Lives in the Balance website. We talked about it. I gave out the books to everyone. And so it was those people who then started coming to me. And it only started with like three teachers who were interested in getting involved. You know, at first it was because of their own children at home and that they saw the difference it was making with their own children. So our group has grown really slowly. And after 3 years, like we're in our third year now, we have 12 teachers out of, I think we have 25 teachers on staff, 24 teachers on staff that are fully engaged in CPS. Like, they will come and say, hey, I want to have a CPS meeting, or I want to have a CPS conversation, or I want to do the LSEP on this child, and we help facilitate that. So it's slightly different because we still have teachers who haven't done the paradigm shift that, viewing student behavior as developmental rather than manipulative. Like, we still have teachers who are saying doing this because they're trying to manipulate. They're doing this because
they're
just want my attention.
They're trying to get their own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're trying to get their own way, or they're not getting the attention at home, and this is how they're getting it here. So we're working with that, and the way we're trying to filter it through the school is by having our teachers talk about the successes that they're having, and hopefully other people will buy in. But it's a slow process. It's a good process. Like, I love CPS, and I think it is amazing. And we've actually, I'm looking up different studies right now because, as Ross knows, we've got the mayor coming in on May 23rd to talk about this. And I'm going to shift the conversation just slightly. I've been reading the Swedish sort of research that they've done. I believe that you were involved in that, Ross, in the one where they are using, I'm just trying to think what they were using, the data that they got from the SNAP4. Can you talk about the SNAP4?
I think there's only one Swedish study that's been published. So if it's the one off the website, that's an outpatient study, though, not a school study.
Okay, so this was a study with 6 to 13-year-olds who were, and maybe it's not with you, but it says, the collaborative problem solving, and it mentions you in it, but maybe it isn't you.
No, I'm probably familiar with it.
So do you know anything about the SNAP? Like, is that, like, we're going to be asked, I know we are, on how we're going to assess our achievement in this area, the positiveness of it. And I'm just wondering what you would suggest. I know we've used functional assessment. I've looked at the BASC. I really like the BASC. And the SNAP, I'm not really familiar with.
The SNAP is an instrument that focuses exclusively on the symptoms of ADHD. At least the last SNAP that I was familiar with. It's by Jim Swanson, who's a colleague out in California. The big question is, what is it that you want to measure? What is it that you think is going to change as a function of implementing CPS? And the big question is, do you think that by implementing CPS, that will cause symptoms of ADHD, and that's all it focuses on, to move in one direction or another? There are other scales out there, like the Connors, that focuses not only on ADHD, but also on symptoms of oppositional defiant disorder.
We use the Connors.
What's that?
we use the Connors. I'm just looking for something that gives more for the emotional, behavioral, whereas the Connors really isn't into both of those domains. So that's why I'm looking at the Basque.
Well, and it depends on the Basque would give you even a broader of a look. The SNAP is ADHD only. The Connors is ADHD and ODD. And the Basque is a much more broad spectrum checklist.
Okay.
Here's the only thing, and this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Those instruments focus, and this has always been my concern about them, they focus on behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems focuses on lagging skills
mm-hmm.
and unsolved problems, which I would expect to be more directly affected by implementing CPS, because CPS really isn't focused on behavior. We expect behavior to be impacted significantly but also indirectly by solving the problems that are causing those behaviors. And so
right.
if you're asking me which would provide a more direct assessment or evaluation of
mm-hmm.
the things that we would expect to be affected most directly by implementing CPS, it would be
mm-hmm.
something looking at the unsolved problems and lagging skills that CPS addresses directly. Would it be bad to have a behavior checklist along with it just to show for those who are primarily interested in behavior that behavior is also affected? Sure, I've used
mm-hmm.
behavior checklists in all of my studies. And as long as we recognize that there are some interventions that focus on behavior, and that's what they're trying to change. CPS has a more indirect, though significant,
mm-hmm.
effect on behavior, but what it directly affects is lagging skills and unsolved problems, if that makes sense.
It does make a great deal of sense. It's just that when we're looking up to senior management, and they're asking, how is this making a difference? I can talk about the unsolved problems and lagging skills and all of that, but unless it coincides or has some recognition through an assessment tool that people are familiar with, it's more difficult to talk about the positive changes that we're having because they're
yes.
looking for a score.
And just
recognize. That's where I'm kind of at.
Right,
mm-hmm.
and then the only other thing is some of the most powerful data you may be collecting already, and that's data on discipline referrals, suspension, detention.
Yes.
That's pretty powerful stuff that you may not find in a behavior checklist per se, but may be the most powerful data that you could be collecting. But we can certainly talk about that offline at any point along the way if you want, because there's probably more ideas
yeah.
on that. But I also want to give Carol a chance to weigh in on
yes.
this thinkers versus doers thing.
Well, I think I fall into this trap myself sometimes because I consider myself a pretty deep thinker, but where it gets tied up is, you know, how do you then actually translate that thought and that intention into action? And what I find different, as Susan's already mentioned a little bit here, is that the culture of collaborative inquiry is just beginning to become embedded in our teacher union's approach to professional development, although there is still a lot of sit and get offered, which is a bit of a, I don't say hypocrisy, but definitely a contradiction in what we know about what's best practice in adult learning and in professional development for teachers and what is actually happening. And also in our school improvement plans, our plans are actually in Surrey shifting to become based in inquiry questions. So there is some shift now. What I've been struggling with, I was actually in Ontario last week for a 3-day seminar on response to intervention. And what I hadn't realized was in terms of intervention, this type of intervention in general, is that foundation I'll call it a PLC culture for lack of a better term, but that openness to meeting with other professionals and actually looking at your student data, whatever form it may take, and analyzing that as a group and coming up with some plans as a group on how to do better isn't very embedded in a lot of our schools. So I heard people from Saskatchewan and Ontario and from the States, you know, talking about their PLC meetings, and that's a piece that I feel I really need to try and strengthen. I probably wouldn't use the PLC language because in BC it's got some history, but definitely working on that, I think, you know, tying it in through collaborative inquiry and saying, you know, if we are working in collaboration with one another and we are asking questions, then we need to not just say, you know, how can we change our technical practices, you were saying, Tim, or technical, or maybe it was Tom, the technical change, and actually making it more of a philosophical, cultural change.
Yeah, or an adaptive change, yeah.
What I think where I'm just scratching the surface in terms of looking at collaborative projects between staff members, and I think, you know, the trust, the development of trust is, it takes time, and it takes nurturing. And I think as you said, if you don't keep it live, keep that conversation live on the table all the time, it does fall back out of the front of people's minds, and it's much easier for initiatives to die a slow and ignominious death by just being ignored if you don't keep up there.
I have a quick question for the two gentlemen out there. In your schools or in your district...
There are actually three gentlemen on this program, but one is just facilitating. But keep going.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, two that are, you know, directly involved with schools. Are you mandated to do professional development at all staff meetings?
No, but we do nothing but PD during PL. Well, we don't use PLCs for PD per se, but I've made it in my building clear that as long as we are working toward our goals as a building, our staff meetings are designed to be PD from my leadership. But that's done through support so that the meetings don't get absorbed into when is the field trip, what's going on Friday. So that's a conscious decision on my part. It's not a district mandate. And then the PLCs, they have more flexibility to talk about student work or their goals or whatever they're working on with the students. But I only have three grade teams in this building, but I go to a lot of PLCs to make sure that time is spent discussing students.
Mm-hmm.
I think from our perspective, we have asked our principals to focus mainly on professional development in the staff meetings.
Yeah.
Now, there's no police of that, and there's no accounting for how much time did you spend, but that's certainly the focus.
Yeah.
That's interesting because here the focus tends to be more on managerial. I know that there are some principals who get in and do some professional development at the beginning of a staff meeting, but it doesn't take very much time. It's not the focus of a staff meeting. The focus is more, would you agree, Carol, is more managerial?
Yeah, it's more let's discuss these upcoming events. Let's talk about,
yeah,
you know, how we're going to be doing our sports day or, you know, these up, you know, Earth Month or, you know, it's those things that you don't get a chance to talk about. We get, and I don't know the frequency and duration of your staff meetings, but ours are once per month for about an hour and 15 minutes, maybe two,
yep,
you know, maybe an hour and a half. So, you know, the amount of time that we have with our staffs is often really limited because we don't have the other functions of, like, the PLCs and release time, grade-level meetings, and we don't have those other avenues to meet with our staff.
I think it's really difficult because, you know, as we move towards this model, we're changing the rules for our leaders.
Uh-huh.
I think we need to be really, really careful to make sure that our leaders have an opportunity to be members of a professional learning community before we ask them to be lead facilitators in professional learning communities. So my question would be, do your principals have an opportunity? Is there a structured learning network for principals?
Yes, we actually have a professional learning community where we meet once a month for an hour and a half. And what happens is every month a different principal facilitates so that they can practice and see how other people facilitate and learn skills.
That's fantastic.
That's
cool,
Tom.
We asked for it as a group. We have a really good team, our leadership team in this district. The principals are very collegial and collaborative, and we actually went on a retreat, four of us, last summer, and came back and presented a plan that was readily accepted by the superintendent and the other leaders for ways that we could build in collaboration and have more productive meetings.
Right. And you know, can I just
that's the sorry, go ahead. Carol, go ahead.
Okay, well, I was going to just say, you know, I know with a teacher-based PLC, they look at data and information. What do you bring to the table for your administrator PLCs?
Yeah, yeah. Tim, have we answered your questions to help you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, just didn't kind of, you know, we've been going. I think we all got excited by your ideas. I know I did.
Yeah.
You know, if I could, I think the question, and I wasn't sure whether it was Carol or Sue who raised it, about what is the content of principal learning networks or leadership PLCs,
mm-hmm.
If I caught that correct.
Yes.
Question correctly.
Yes.
And, you know, we've looked at some work by Stephen Katz and Lisa Dack that asked that very question. And we've been trying to do principal learning networks for about 8 years, and it hasn't been until this year where we've really felt like we've done a good job with them. And the mistake that we have been making is we get leaders together to talk, and they've been talking about teaching challenge of practices as opposed to leadership challenges of practice.
Uh-huh.
And those are two very different things. It's very easy to talk about. I could share what one of my really great teachers is doing with you, and you can take that back, and one of your really great teachers can start doing that, but that really won't get us anywhere. Are we really talking about the leadership skills or the facilitation skills or those challenges that leaders face on a day-to-day basis in building culture? That's what ours are focusing on, and like I said, after 8 years, this is the first year we've got there, but Katz and Dack work called Intentional Interruption has really helped us with that.
Yeah. Hey, Tim, can I piggyback off that real quickly and just say one thing that we implemented to help that culture is we started in my building doing learning walks. So I'll teach kindergarten or first grade or second grade, and then the guidance counselor will teach a class, and then the we'll grab someone else to teach a class, and then three or four teachers will go with the literacy coach with a checklist and go and walk through four other teachers' classrooms to see the teaching and learning. And then they talk about it, and it's been amazing, the difference it's made in the collaborative culture. The one thing I've not heard a single – they were terrified at first, but once we got it up and running, the comments from people were they couldn't believe all the amazing things that were going on in the school, and they couldn't believe the positive feedback that they got back from their colleagues after having them walk through. So everyone has been a walker, a visitor. And everyone's been a host classroom now at this point in the year. And now the feedback is, can't wait to do it again. And I'd actually been wondering, how could we do that for collaborative and proactive solutions? How could we have learning walks for collaborative? And, I mean, it's just I have some ideas, but anyway, Ross, that might be another day.
I love it. I love listening to you guys talk. We have this is always such a rich program, and Tim, you have added to the mix. We have about a minute left. Anybody have any final thoughts on learners versus doers or anything else that we've talked about today?
I'm just wondering if Tim would be okay with sharing his contact information with us through your email, Ross, so that we can maybe follow up if we have other questions or
I will email all of you with Tim's email and phone number.
That's fantastic. I want to thank everyone for the information today. I've actually been taking notes on different, you know, books and things, and I just want to thank you for doing that. It's kind of opens our eyes. We kind of get stuck in one thing, and it's neat to, like, this intentional interruption. I think that's something I'm going to definitely go out and research. That's good.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Tim. I really appreciate you being on today. I am apologizing once again for the screw-up on the phone number, but otherwise we could have had an additional 10 minutes with you. But I think this has been very informative, at least for me, and I knew that our group of principals here would love chatting with you. So I appreciate you coming on, and I hope you'll do it again maybe in the fall if we can have you back.
I'd love to. You know where to find me. Thanks for the opportunity.
I know where to find you, and don't rely on me for the phone number next time, right? This is our final Helping Behaviorally Challenging Students program until September. So thanks to our educators panel for participating during this broadcast year. We'll be back again next year. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Have a great summer, everybody.
Thank you.